So what can you do? What can you do realistically, you know, that takes into account what you are about? Well, here is what you can do. Ignore the activists, ignore the revolutionaries. We have to face bullets, we have to face military trials. It doesn't matter really what you do. It doesn't matter if Facebook is going to reveal my information or not. I have to assume that I'm being constantly watched, that I'm being that everything about me is public. It doesn't matter. But what matters is ordinary users who use your products to practice their agency. When you decide that they cannot decide to choose a pseudonym, then you are negating them the right to negotiate their identity. The right to negotiate your identity is, it's not in the Charter of Human Rights, but it's actually essential to most rights. Negotiated identity is very important. I get to choose whether to reveal who I am and how to reveal who I am and decide who I am on my own terms and on my own basis.
This text is being read in East London on the 18th of May, 2022, at 11 p.m. The title is Gaza, On Being Prisoner to Your Own Victory, page 69. So we went to Palestine. A life's dream that had taken on almost mythical dimensions, but came true with a bus journey and some bureaucracy. We went in search of hills and valleys, za'atar and olive trees, stone houses, mosques and churches, oranges and guns, kafirs and the wreckage of war. Surprise number one. Gaza is normal. A coastal city that resembles Egyptian cities in most details, as if I'm in Agami Abu Talat. Even the people looked, dressed, and talked like people in Egypt. We searched for the siege like curious tourists, though we said we came as comrade siege breakers. On the surface, the blockade was over. The markets are bustling and the supermarkets are fully stocked. The tunnels take care of whatever was missing. The whole way from Palestine, Rafah, to Gaza City, huge lorries are transporting tunnel goods. We philosophize and theorize. So Gaza isn't going hungry. This constant talk of starvation must be to someone's benefit. The first signs of the siege appear at our hotel. The electricity comes and goes because there's a fuel crisis. And water supplies are limited and the desalination plants aren't working at capacity. Of course, water and energy problems afflict our Egyptian cities. I'm just not used to encountering them in an expensive hotel in a fancy neighborhood. We philosophize and theorize. Does the siege flatten class distinctions then? And another thing we looked for, with tourists' eyes, was the wreckage of war. Where are the bombed out buildings and schools? Apart from the Andalus Tower, the traces of war are negligible. Bullet marks on a few buildings. How strange. Why didn't they leave rubble to weep over? We philosophize and theorize. The lack of rubble and debris surely explains the absence of brilliant poetry. The next Mahmoud Darwish won't come out of Gaza. Surprise number two, Gaza is dystopian. Our hotel is on the seafront. The sea is the same as ours. No surprise that it looks the same. But night falls, and the sea is fenced in by floodlights. To make sure the siege is absolute, the enemy has caged the sea itself. Usually, it isn't possible to engage with any geographical unit larger than a neighborhood, or maybe a village, as a material entity that we can grasp with our senses. Cities, regions, and nations are essentially symbolic entities. To see Egypt as a whole, you have to look at a map. You have to engage with ideas about history, a nation, and other symbols, the Nile or the pyramids, or maybe Tahrir Square. The Zionists have succeeded in treating the Gaza Strip as a physical body that can be caged and walled in, even its sea. This achievement in itself is legendary and beyond my ability to comprehend. The vocabulary and the details of the siege seem like they're out of a science fiction novel set in humanity's dark future. An entire society behind bars, the sea fenced in, hovering robots that can kill you at any moment, aeroplanes roaring through the sound barrier at all hours, an economy of underground tunnels, and a mighty hidden enemy whose agents are concrete, iron, and fire. You never see it, but it is always present. In Terminator, the computer Skynet achieves self-awareness in August 1997, and then world domination. In 2029, human resistance inflicts major losses on Skynet, which starts to send killer cyborgs back in time to stamp out the resistance in its cradle. In current human consciousness, the siege of Gaza cannot be permitted. Human society doesn't countenance killer robots. We still talk about war in the language of knights, where you meet the enemy face to face, and courage and strength are more important than equipment. What's happening in Gaza, and some of it is happening in other places around the world, is out of context, like it's been sent back in time from some grim future we haven't arrived at yet. We don't philosophize or theorize. We shy away from thinking about it. Surprise number 3, Gaza is free. Gaza looks like Egypt, but something's different. Every wall, every building, every street corner is inscribed with the names of the martyrs. Every family proudly declares its fallen. The traces of war are few, but its stories are plenty, and on everyone's tongues. Behind an everyday scene is a history of persistent, determined struggle. I knew that, of course, but I hadn't realized that it was struggle on every corner. I was confused and thought that the Zionists withdrew to hold Gaza under a tight siege. But a visit shows you that they withdrew because it was impossible to sustain their presence there, facing such struggle and resistance. The distinction is familiar. Gaza no longer looks like Agami Abu Talat, but Muhammad Mahmoud Street. Every inch of it has been paid for in blood, and every inch remembers its martyrs with graffiti and murals. The occupation wasn't a match for them, so it withdrew and relinquished the land of Gaza. And the Egyptian regime was no match for us, so it withdrew its president and pulled out of Tahrir and Muhammad Mahmoud Street. Gaza defeated the occupation, so the occupation withdrew, leaving the siege in its wake. And Gaza has defeated the siege. Gaza forged its freedom from the blood of its children. And here, in reconstructing its buildings, by recycling its rubble. We're not seeing any ruins because the people of Gaza are busy with life, prizing out and flattening the rebar from the rubble, grinding up the ruins into new cement and bricks. The Palestinian is one who struggles to live a normal life under endlessly extraordinary conditions. In Egypt, too, we've been living under extraordinary circumstances for the last year and a half. But while in Egypt some try to flee the extraordinary, in Gaza every street is Mohammed Mahmoud Street. In Gaza no one flees. In Gaza everyone cherishes the extraordinary conditions as much as they do normal life, but they do not immortalize them. Surprise number four, Gaza is divided. The streets are not only decorated with the names and faces of the martyrs, but with the banners of the factions. Each house raises its standard, green for Hamas, yellow for Fatah, red for the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, black for Islamic Jihad. Everyone belongs. Everyone talks about their faction, everyone complains about being divided. Even the pictures of the martyrs are coupled with a tribute to their faction. It seems as if all representatives of authority and of the state are from Hamas. Their appearance and manner testifies to their faction. The two authorities are a subject of constant discussion, anywhere, with anyone, any time. The lurking anger, I understand. Arab authorities have track records of flouting the rights of their citizens. What I don't understand is the anger lurking among the representatives of the authority. Where does that come from? And there are so many representatives of the authority. Things take a funny turn. Transforming the science fiction story from a dystopia to a black comedy. Informers are everywhere. It's impossible to move around without bumping into them, despite the siege, the occupation, the fighting, and the historical events. They still find the time and energy to enforce gender segregation and the veil. Their excuses are at the ready. Gaza is in a critical situation. This is a military zone. Gaza is targeted, traditions and customs. Okay, the similarities are still there. We philosophize and theorize. Fear dominates Gaza. No one speaks freely. I don't understand the Hamas plainclothes insistence on fighting with us. We're only visitors. In 5 days, we'll be gone. Even Mubarak knew how to play the margins of freedom game. Why are these guys determined to mess with us? We try to ignore the disunity, but everybody is talking about it. We try to ignore the Hamas authority, but one of its arms insists on intimidating us. Everyone says the same thing. The same frustration, the same impotence, the same anger. Nothing is happening. Nothing has meaning. We philosophize and theorize. You need a revolution. They say that the prisoners' hunger strike has united the people. We try to get away from the feuding by visiting a sit-in held by the prisoners' families. They are on hunger strike in solidarity with their children. But the feuding catches up with us. The sit-in itself is divided by faction. Placards declaring the allegiance of each prisoner. A megaphone blasting non-stop partisan speeches. Arguments over whether men are allowed to visit women's tents to meet with prisoners' mothers, wives, sisters, daughters and aunts. Finally, we enter the tent. I don't know how I can talk to a mother who's been kept from seeing her son for 7 years. I'm rescued by my own, Khalid, who was with me on the trip, when the mothers ask about him. I want to tell them he was born while I was in prison, to show I understand some of the torment. But I'm ashamed to compare 2 months inside with decades of imprisonment. I make up my mind to speak because what's important is to emphasize the similarity between Egypt's rulers and the Zionists. Even the mothers of the prisoners, struggling for their own liberation, ask about Egypt and hope for a breakthrough in Palestine built on the victory of our revolution. We philosophize and theorize. You have to overcome the factions first. Surprise number 5. Gaza is occupied. I'm suffocated by moving around as if I were a tourist. I'm anxious about the disunity dominating the scene. It's clear that my son Khalid is the key to more intimate interaction. I split from the group and walk around the city with him. Al-Shatir camp resembles any low-income neighborhood in Egypt. The market looks familiar, but here goods coming from Israel dominate. I gather that the poor cannot afford tunnel goods. Gaza may give you the impression that the blockade is over, with its shops filled with all kinds of goods, with its people's resentment of the starvation discourse, which verges on begging. But the working poor remain at the mercy of what Israel decides to let in. The population density is higher in the camp, and so is the density of factional flags. It looks like I'm moving between each faction's neighborhoods. All are delighted with Khalid, but they differ in their analysis of the situation in Egypt. The residents of the camp don't follow what's happening in Egypt minute by minute the way that the Facebook and Twitter generation of young Palestinians do. But they do stay abreast of events. There's no sofa party in Gaza. Whatever your social background, everyone has an opinion. It's easy for us to brag about transcending partisanship in Egypt. But in Palestine, factional allegiance means a lot more because each faction has a genuine history of struggle, a record of sacrifice, and a popular base. I'm beginning to understand why the young people we met, who seemed closest to the youth of the Egyptian regime, who seemed closest to the youth of the Egyptian revolution, raised a banner to end the division rather than down with the regime. Ending the division is a call to radically change the system while maintaining the role and status of the factions. But then why were they repressed by the two authorities and abandoned by most of the factions? Even though everyone agrees that ending the division is necessary to confront the occupier. My anxiety swells to a peak. I need to see the hidden enemy. I make my way, with my family, to the Beit Hanun crossing, Erez checkpoint, the gateway leading to the rest of the occupied territories. The police don't let us get close. Our friends understand our need to see the enemy. So they take us to a small farm on the outskirts of Beit Hanun, the closest point to the Zionist wall we could reach. And finally, we see the enemy. On the horizon, concrete walls, surveillance towers and jeeps. A friend, who had just been trying to explain to me what it meant to be born a Palestinian refugee on Palestinian land, tells me that the barracks I see on the Israeli side of the crossing had been built on the ruins of his village. At the edge of an orchard, he invites me to pick a fruit. I walk around the tree and suddenly they yell, "Careful, the enemy is watching you now." One step beyond the limit can bring dire consequences. Finally here, within range of the enemy's bullets and under the buzz of its drones, my anxiety subsides. We taunt them a little by getting as close as possible to photograph them. We stroll, taking no notice of their unhidden presence. And finally, we have our calmest and purest moments in Palestine. We talk about everything, children and land and work, revolution and occupation and division, politics and football and love. At the wall, anxiety ends. At the wall, the fog dissipates. At the wall, the impact of war is clear. Not in the rubble of destroyed buildings, but in the youth of the trees. One shot sums it all up. Everything old was swept away, but we were not defeated, and we planted anew. At the wall, I understand the significance of the blockade. They tell me how difficult it is to obtain seeds, fertilizer, and fodder. The tunnel economy isn't a proper economy. It doesn't provide raw materials or the supplies required for industry and agriculture. Tunnels are only good business for consumer goods. The occupation expends effort and money and builds complexes of concrete and technology, mainly to prevent Gaza from having real economic activity. The enemy fences off the sea with its huge battleships, just to stop fishermen in tiny boats from reaching their sardines. The Palestinian is one who struggles to live a normal life under endlessly extraordinary conditions. The successive victories of the people of Gaza forced the occupation to withdraw. So the occupation decided to leave them prisoners to their own victory, to deprive them of the most important tool of struggle, the ability to live a normal life. For no matter how normal life seems on the surface of Gaza, the reality is the opposite. As long as the vast majority of its people are unable to work for a living, estimates of unemployment range between 60 and 80%. The influx of money and goods from outside is not an alternative. They've created a prison in the true sense of the word, then. For in prison, the majority don't work. In prison, also, there is an underground smuggling economy. The currency is cigarettes. But it's not real life. I remember my own short experience in confinement when they imprisoned 50 people from the Kefaya movement together and how the overcrowded cells were too much for us to handle. How we snapped at each other, bickered and quarreled, and even accused each other of treachery. Once we got out, the tensions all evaporated and we couldn't even remember what they were about. I remember Dr. Mohammed Habib in Asayut telling us about his experience of being in prison for years and how struggle and ambition shrink until they can fit into the cell. And the definition of freedom becomes controlling when the door is open and when it's closed. That day, he told us a joke that he'd stopped calling his wife the government and started calling her the warden. After years in prison, you can no longer imagine any greater power. He warned us of following in the footsteps of generations whose horizon had fallen so low it stopped at the prison warden. Today, in Gaza, I understood that it's not about generational inheritance. Anyone can become so consumed by cell block conflicts that they can no longer see beyond the warden. The problem isn't Hamas or Fatah. The problem is in accepting becoming prisoner to your victory. Defeating the warden, then doing nothing more than taking his place. The tunnels started as an act of resistance, but today they're a source of tax revenue for the government and profit for the elite. Without Gazans choosing this, with every day that goes by, the authority adapts to the situation and those making money crawl higher up. Today, it's Palestinian police who maintain security at the wall and try to keep everybody away from it, both the fighter with his rocket launcher and the farmer who sees fertile land being deliberately laid to waste. Evil is not their motive. Surely they are trying to protect people from the brutality of the occupation, to protect the country from an excuse for large-scale bombing. But the result is the same. They have become jailers. The authority is not implicated on its own. If unemployment affects everyone and the economy is largely rendered ineffective, how can class inequality persist? What does the impact of the blockade vary? Class inequality is always objectionable, but in most societies, it can be explained by market dynamics. In Gaza, it seems to be partially inherited. Before the blockade, we were like this, and so we will continue to be so. Young people realize how fake this situation is, so are on the lookout for a discourse and a movement that pushes up against the barriers. They're tired of being prisoners of their own victory. Sometimes they join the fishermen, fishing in spite of the battleships. At others, the farmers harvesting beneath the drones. They demonstrate in support of the Arab revolutions without asking permission from any authority. They raise a slogan that seems conciliatory and logical, like, "The people demand an end to division." But in truth, it's revolutionary because it means demand an end to the role of the warden. Perhaps Gaza won't produce the next Mahmoud Darwish, but it produces angry rap, critical of everybody, poignant in its celebrations. Their fatigue and their anger, as well as their moments of joy, is inventing a new discourse of resistance, free of the vocabulary monopolized by the factions. In Egypt, too, they wanted to imprison us inside our victory. We liberated Tahrir Square and downtown Cairo. We toppled a warden and his henchmen. They tried to confine us to Tahrir, and in Tahrir we moved from the victor's utopia to the squabbling of cramped cells. That's why all our attempts to recreate the mood of the square in the square fail. Our youth set out on a feverish search for a new goal, moving from ministries to embassies, our hearts reassured when met with walls, bullets, and blood. Now I understand why Abbasiyya and the Ministry of Defense called to us. In Egypt, too, we might end up electing a new warden. Now I understand why anxiety soars whenever we approach elections. We have paid for it in blood. The first group to call for an end to division were the political prisoners. Today, the prisoners' hunger strikes. Today, the prisoners' hunger strike is leading the struggle of an entire people. And when the authorities and the factions try to take control, the prisoners remind them with resolute courtesy that it's shameful for a well-fed free man to negotiate on behalf of a hungry prisoner. How can we allow ourselves to be overcome with weakness, prisoners to our victory, when prisoners are achieving victory in their confinement? The last surprise, returning. On the last day, I'm determined to buy olive oil. How could I visit Palestine and not bring back olive oil? I also have with me two flowers planted in Palestinian soil. But the day passes by with all its disruptions, and I don't find time to buy the oil. And at the crossing on the way back, I forget the two flowers and the soil. Fate decided to deprive me of trivializing Palestine into any of its cliched symbols nested in my imagination. Do you seek out the words of Mahmoud Darwish and ignore the lyrics of young rappers? Do you look for rubble and destruction and ignore the people you've seen flattening out bomb-twisted steel rebar to build new houses? Do you look for za'atar and olive oil and ignore that you've shared a coffee with someone struggling to grow them? Do you look for the fighter with the gun and the kafir and ignore the fisherman and the farmer and the student who struggle every day to stay alive? Do you search for the land of Palestine and ignore that your son was blessed for days with the love of its people? Gaza stands fearlessly, calling out to us, "Come, for I have the truth." People who love life and desire freedom, "Come, for I have the last wall. If it falls, so will every wall, and every warden, and every jailer in Egypt as in Syria. Look for the walls. The enemy is always behind them, and the truth always lies before them." We arrive home. In a small bag, I have some Asgardenia fruits. The poets have never sung its praises. Wikipedia says it originated in China. But it's a delicious fruit from Palestine, planted in spite of the siege and beside the wall. A friend picked them for us. Yes, I was in Palestine. Yes, I returned, and Palestine is with me. Published on 18th of May, 2012, in Al-Shuruq.
We are calling for the immediate release of Alaa Abd al-Fattah. Join us on freealaa.net to find out how you can help.